Truce talks in the desert. Iraq agrees to all Allied demands. An Iraqi diplomat announces the first release of Allied POWs. And a jetliner crash in Colorado. All on board are killed. This is the CBS Evening News. Connie Chung reporting.
Connie Chung is a pioneer, the youngest of 10 children. She was the only one born in the U.S. after her parents escaped war-torn China and a harrowing journey to America, where Connie would one day make history as the first woman and Asian to co-anchor the CBS Evening News. Profoundly influenced by her family's cultural traditions, yet growing up completely Americanized, she dealt with overt sexism and racism. Despite this, her tenacity led her to become a household name. In her new book, Connie, a Memoir, she reveals behind-the-scenes details of her singular life, from the close relationship with Maury Povich, her husband and professional confidant, to a horrific memory of being molested by the doctor who had delivered her, to her joy of adopting their son when she was almost 50. It is a book where she does not hold back. We are the recipients of a beautiful story told, Connie, a memoir, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Connie Chung to the roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us. What a delight to have you on the program.
Well, Joe, it's even more delightful for me to join you. I mean, with your history over all these years, it's an honor.
Thank you very, very much. I have to say, you mentioned this in the book, and I did this morning, but I was I realized I hadn't taken the script off my desk. So I ran back to my desk. I got the script, and then I ran in, I sat down, and then I was completely out of breath. You tell a story like that in the book.
Yes.
Of when you're getting ready to do, I believe, a news update. And it's just those kind of things, you know, as long as you do it, those kind of things still happen.
They do. I mean, I was reporting from Capitol Hill, and I was supposed to be on the top floor of one of the House office buildings. I actually came to the elevator. I was running late, and I got to the elevator, and it had a big fat sign that said out of order. So I had to run up the marble steps of this building in my very high heels. And I always wore very high heels because I'm only 5'3½". Sadly, I've even shrunk 3 inches. So now it's worse. I probably come up to your navel, Joe. And I ran all the way up the steps. And I think it was about 9 floors, maybe, or it could have been more. And by the time I got there, the camera crew was there. I couldn't speak. I was out of breath. And you know that's the worst feeling for someone who's a broadcaster. If you can't breathe, you can't talk.
You talk in the book about how you come to the profession. And it's interesting because it seems that it doesn't take you very long in your very young adult life that you knew what you wanted to do.
Well, it didn't happen, though. I mean, in college, I thought I knew what I wanted to do, and I majored in biology because I did well in it in high school. But then I thought, after I got really into it and having a lot of lab classes, I found it so boring. So it took me 4 years to figure out what I wanted to do. But yes, you're right, Joe. As soon as I decided, in my senior year, really, the summer between my junior year and senior year, then I was focused and I was driven and determined and couldn't stop myself, really. I never would stop and take a pause.
You say, my eyes were wide open. I knew every experience was helping to prime me for the future, including my first encounter with political malfeasance, and you go on to tell that story. But what it was like in that year, and you ended up adding a year because you had changed your major, but it is fascinating of how much you can learn and get ready to be released into the world.
But you know what? I don't know about you, but I don't think necessarily that journalism is a teachable course. I think in college, I would always recommend that young people major in history or English, mm-hmm. or political science, because I think we as news people need that kind of background. News becomes history the next day, and we always see history repeating itself, and how politics is cyclical too. So I think political science, history, or English, because you get a lot of writing, and it trains your mind to figure out what you want to say on paper. And then in the case of television, then we utter whatever we wrote. So when don't you think that being a reporter and being a news person and being on air is really sort of an on-the-job learning process?
I do, absolutely. And sometimes I think I kid myself by thinking that I've been doing this for a long time. Nothing can happen that I'm not ready for. And then something happens that I'm not ready for.
Yeah. You're very, how humble for you to say that, because I know a lot of people in our business will not say that. But I feel the same way as you, Joe. There's always something new. Every day we really do learn something new. And that's the way it should be.
When you started off and you were in D.C., you talk in the book about Channel 5 family. But when did you feel like, okay, this is what I'm good at? This is what I can bring to the equation.
I think it was probably 40 years later. You know, if I always felt I was learning every day, and to me, everything was a brand new experience. I was wide-eyed about whatever the story was. And that's probably the reason why I found the news business so exciting, because, you know, I really didn't know what was going to happen that day. None of us do. And whatever is the news of the day becomes the story. And whatever I'm assigned to becomes my story of the day. And I found that to be very exciting. It's what we know what our trade and what we need to do, but we don't know what the event is or what's going to happen. And that just makes every day sort of pretty darn interesting and a challenge. I think that's what was so attractive to me about the news business, the unpredictability.
You were at Channel 5, and then you had only been in the news business for 2 years, and you end up at CBS News, the most prestigious nationwide television network. And, oh, by the way, Walter Cronkite's in the anchor chair.
Yeah.
I mean, and you're having meetings with William Paley. I mean, it has to be just nerve-wracking and yet incredibly exciting.
Exactly. I couldn't believe my lucky stars. I really was. I can think of so many cliches. I really was pinching myself, because this was the dream job. This was the job that I always wanted, to be a reporter on Walter Cronkite's news. He was the quintessential anchor man who was trusted and honest and worthy of every accolade that any of us can ever think of. And he was a nice man, Joe. Mm. So he was a very endearing soul, unlike a lot of other anchormen who thought they were God's gift to broadcasting.
You talk in the book about people who have big shot itis, and yeah, and that wasn't something that a malady he had.
No, he was down to earth. And I mean, I remember the first time I actually saw him in person. He came to the Washington Bureau, where I was working as a reporter, and he anchored the news from Washington, as he would do sometimes if there was a big Washington story. And after the news, he went around and shook everybody's hand who had come to see him. People brought their families in and children and whatever. And he would ask them questions and, you know, be interested in them. And he took a long time going from family to family. And I thought, oh my goodness. And we'd see him for maybe a drink or dinner or whatever. And he never treated us like lesser people. And it was genuine. I mean, you can tell when someone is kind of faking congeniality. And there were many in our Washington bureau who weren't genuine. It was very black and white to me. I could tell that he was a wonderful person from the get-go.
This is my last broadcast as the anchorman of the CBS Evening News. For me, it's a moment for which I long have planned, but which nevertheless comes with some sadness. For almost two decades, after all, we've been meeting like this in the evenings, and I'll miss that. But those who have made anything of this departure, I'm afraid, have made too much. This is but a transition, a passing of the baton. A great broadcaster and gentleman, Doug Edwards, preceded me in this job, and another, Dan Rather, will follow. And anyway, the person who sits here is but the most conspicuous member of a superb team of journalists, writers, reporters, editors, producers, and none of that will change. Furthermore, I'm not even going away. I'll be back from time to time with special news reports and documentaries, and beginning in June, every week with our science program, Universe. Old anchormen, you see, don't fade away. They just keep coming back for more. And that's the way it is. Friday, March 6th, 1981. I'll be away on assignment, and Dan Rather will be sitting in here for the next few years. Good night.
This has been the CBS Evening News with Walter Cronkite.
Connie Chung is our guest. Her new book is Connie, a Memoir. We'll be back with more after this. Welcome back to the Roundtable. Our guest is iconic trailblazer and legendary journalist Connie Chung, whose memoir is Connie. She pulls no punches in detailing her storied career as the first Asian woman to break into an overwhelmingly white, male-dominated television news industry.
You write in the book, "For me, every day was a test. Would I measure up? My being a woman was a bigger challenge than my race. I wanted to be accepted and treated just like my male colleagues when we all covered the male-dominated world of politics at the White House, Capitol Hill, the Pentagon, and the State Department. Everywhere I looked, there were men. Since I wanted to fit in, I became one of them." It's actually how you start off the book in telling about how you really were very Zelig-like in that of going into an all-male environment and being one of the guys.
Yeah, it wasn't a major conscious thought-out decision. It's just something that I could see. I couldn't see myself, so I didn't know that I wasn't a man. So I thought, you know what I mean? I'm looking around and I thought, well, why can't I be just like them? I mean, I dare say I was really kind of a sassy badass. I was trash talking just the way they did. And it kind of threw them off course because they didn't quite know what to do with this little Asian thing, a woman certainly, because we were sparse. There were just a few here and there. And add to the fact that I was an aberration. I was an aardvark. It was an unusual presence in the newsroom. So I thought, well, I'll just be one of them. And I think the more I hung around and sort of acted like them, they kind of eventually were blind to who they saw. And Joe, I had a sense of humor. And I remember Roger Mudd saying, that served me well. I didn't take their sort of sexual innuendo seriously. And I would throw one back at them before they could throw one at me. And I wondered how I was so sharp back then, because right now I can't think of anything quickly.
Well, that, you know, a lot of that's just not doing it every day, right? And
well, yeah.
Let me ask you this question. You've got this beat. It's an incredible beat. You're in DC. You're interviewing President Ford, and you're at impeachment hearings of President Nixon, the congressional hearings into the impeachment. You are doing all of these assignments, and yet they still are often relegating you to stories that they feel should be done by a woman.
Yes. I had to cover Pat Nixon a lot, President Nixon's wife. And it's not that, you know, I didn't want to cover her. It's just that she never did anything that was newsworthy. And we all knew that. It was just what was called protective coverage, just in case something happened. I would watch Ed Bradley, who was in our bureau for a brief time in Washington. I'd watch him be called by the assignment editor and being told to cover a Pat Nixon event. And he would look at him and say, no, just flat out, no. And but when I was asked, I found it very hard to not be cooperative. So I lumped it.
You say your favorite politician was Nelson Rockefeller.
Yes.
What was it about Rockefeller that made him, I assume, not only someone that you liked, but a good interview?
He understood the relationship between a reporter and a politician. So when I would pepper him with questions that were tough questions, he knew that he could give me a tough answer back and look better for it. Many politicians who think we reporters are the enemy and are out to get them recoil at tough questions. They think we are adversaries. But I think the ones who understand the Fourth Estate know that we're just trying to get at the truth. And they either tell us the truth or they find a way around it. The good news, I think, is that viewers and readers know that we're asking the questions that they want answered. Back then, they don't begrudge the fact that we are tough on politicians or tough on anybody we're questioning. It's a different paradigm today, but we don't want to get into that, do we, Joe?
No, we'll have enough of that in our lives, won't we?
I agree.
George McGovern tried to kiss you.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was like, oh, all right, well, that is awful, but it doesn't surprise me. And then you tell the story about Jimmy Carter, and I was like, Jimmy Carter?
I know.
Jimmy Carter got all footsie with you.
It was a real shock to me too, Joe. I was sitting at a black tie dinner, seated next to him, and he was a former president at that time. He had just given Playboy magazine an interview in which he said he sometimes lusts in his heart. And all of a sudden, I feel his knee pressing against my knee. And I looked up at him, you know, because it was such a shock. And he smiled. And I think I saw that look that he was talking about. And I went, oh, how creepy.
Yeah. I wasn't quite prepared for that anecdote. What was it like to cover in the way that you did? I mean, you had a piece of the Watergate story. I mean, this is one of the great journalistic experiences, I would think, that you would have as a young reporter to cover something that ultimately brought down an administration.
It was the story of the decade, and I think all of us knew it. So we were being extraordinarily careful. And CBS wanted us to be careful because we knew that the presidency was at stake. So we would check all our sources before we ever reported anything. And it was very hard to keep up with Woodward and Bernstein, who were breaking stories every morning. But some of us got somewhere here and there. I just felt as if it was such an important, all emotionally enthralling event in which members of Congress on both sides of the aisle, both in the Senate and Congress, were the House of Representatives, I should say, could feel the weight of their decision making. I was actually very proud of our country for, you know, being fair in that entire episode, because Nixon, the president actually saw the writing on the wall and he graciously resigned. Didn't put the country through any more turmoil. You know, Joe, I was so wrapped up in covering that story that after Watergate was over, I almost thought there's nothing else to cover in Washington that could ever be as important or serious. And little did I know, it keeps happening. There are more and more things in Washington.
It's a well that never goes dry. But
no,
it is interesting because at that point, after covering Watergate and McGovern and Rockefeller, you did it opposite. You're supposed to go spend your years in a local market, maybe even a big city market, and then go to the network. You were at the network, and then you went to L.A. because you felt you wanted something different and you wanted to be on the air and you wanted different stories. And that's what you got.
But it was also a personal decision. I had been living at home with my parents until I was 30 years old. And I was about to turn 30. And when I got this job offer to go to California, to Los Angeles, to anchor the news, I thought, yeah, I think I should go. Plus, they were paying me like three times more than I was making at CBS News in New York. Even though it was turning back the clock and going backwards, I really felt that since I had the responsibility of supporting my parents, which landed in my lap, I decided that I would get out of Dodge and go live in Los Angeles independently. You know, I was very much like Barbara Walters. She had her father's nightclubs had tanked, and she became the breadwinner in her family. My father had a mild heart attack at the time, and he retired from a federal government job that he had. And I was the breadwinner in my family. So for both of us, we had to have a job. We were like men. We were the breadwinners. We couldn't get fired because we had obligations.
Your parents then, I mean, you do your best to elude them, but they follow you around. I mean, they weren't ready to give up that gravy train.
No, that's exactly right. They said, guess what? We're moving out to be with you. And I go, oh, you're kidding.
And there you go.
So how can I? It's very hard to say no, you know. I think a lot of young professionals experience role reversal with their elderly parents. And then there's the sandwich generation who then have children and elderly parents. So many people were in the same boat as I was.
We will continue our special conversation with Connie Chung and discuss the NBC years coming up next on WAMC. Connie Chung is our guest this morning. Her new memoir is Connie. The book is published by Grand Central. After a few years broadcasting in Los Angeles, Connie came back east to work for the Peacock Network, NBC, which she points out stands for Nobody But Connie. She takes the job as host of the lead-in news program to NBC's Today Show.
I'm Connie Chung. News is constantly changing. To deliver a story clearly and accurately, you've got to be there where the news is happening. On NBC News at Sunrise, we go where the news is.
Join Connie Chung for news, business, weather, and sports on NBC News at Sunrise starting Monday.
I mean, that seems like a great gig because you're going into a show that is very popular, but then also your work schedule was just nuts. I mean, you were doing that. You were coming back later in the day. You were filling in all over the place. You were working 6 days a week. My goodness.
I must have been crazy. I really wanted to get back to the East Coast to network news. I had, you know, spent a good many years, seven years, I think, in L.A. So I was ready to get back into the thick of network news and covering stories, covering politics. I really asked for it. I asked for a grueling 6-day-a-week schedule. I really wanted to come back to national news and plant my feet solidly in the ground there again. And honestly, I don't know how I did those crazy hours. Well, for one thing, though, I was young-ish. I was in my 30s. So I think being in my 30s, I was able to burn the candle at both ends. Boy, am I full of cliches today.
Well, and you want to succeed. I mean, you want to get ahead and to do what you need to do in this business and take the opportunities that you can get.
Exactly. I just, I wasn't going to sit still, and I worked hard. Honestly, I think that's what a lot of women do. We don't accept the fact that we don't have to work hard. We feel we have to prove ourselves. That was the onus that I lived with, perhaps in my own mind, but also I think in other people's minds. I needed to make sure that they knew I was serious about my career.
You mentioned early on about having a sense of humor, and that was one of the things. That's when I fell for you, because you would go on Letterman, and you and Dave would go shopping for shoe trees for Maury. I mean, and you're going from up and down in the city, and then he's out with you, Letterman's out with you, a big bus with Maury's picture on it comes by from A Current Affair, and you're making, you know, size jokes about their feet. It's just delightful. It's absolutely delightful.
Connie, let's check in here. Hi, we need to pick up some special order shoe trees.
Special order shoe trees for Connie's husband, Murray. He has problem feet.
We he doesn't have problem order. Feet.
Is it when he has extra wide feet?
No, I think they're right over here.
Oh, those are beauties. Look at those, Connie.
That's great.
What exactly do, what's the purpose of shoe trees? What do they do?
Keeps the shape of the shoes.
Uh-huh. Well, don't your feet do that? Let me buy the shoe trees.
No, really?
All right, turn off the cameras. Turn off the cameras. See, if you on 60 Minutes, if you can get a guy to do that on camera, say, turn off, then you're set for life.
Yes, you're right.
How much is it?
David, I can't have you pay for this.
Stop the whining. Just don't whine, please.
Maury's going to be very upset.
He won't know. How will he know?
Because it's
going to
be on.
Oh, he's never, yeah, like he stays up to see this.
He does.
Pretty much dozes off in his food, doesn't he?
You know, we had this rapport going. I don't know how to describe it, except in many ways I was a straight man for him, and then he was a straight man for me. But we just had this wonderful rat-a-tat that worked. Since I was in the building at NBC, lots of times a guest wouldn't show up or was potentially running late, and they'd call me up, and I was the go-to standby. So lots of times I ended up not really realizing I was going to be on with him that particular night. But it was way too fun.
One of my favorite moments is when they're doing a break and it says, join us tonight on Late Night, where Connie Chung will crack walnuts with her bare hands.
Yes.
NBC Standards and Practices calls up and says, can she really do that? And they said, well, probably not. And they said, well, then you have to nix it. You can't do it. And then there you are weeks later on the show.
Yes.
Cracking walnuts with your bare hands. Now that is a talented person.
Welcome back, folks. Connie is still here, and she's working on crushing walnuts with her bare hands. While she's doing that, let me tell you about tomorrow night's program. Where is that, Kevin? Is that tomorrow night? Comedian Jonathan Katz. Truck stop owner Magpie Richardson, Stupid Petrix, viewer mail, 9-year-old impressionist Zachariah Overton. There's no way in hell you can fully enjoy this program without a $1,200 stereo television set. That'll be tomorrow night. Very nice. Connie Chung, ladies and gentlemen. All right, Connie Chung and her fists of steel. Well,
Letterman's people, they were determined to not abide by the laws set down by NBC. So they were determined to be incorrigible bad boys.
Right.
Which Dave was. He was incorrigible. So they called me up and they said, we'll show you how to break walnuts with your bare hands. Okay. I was in. I was totally in. I was a little fearful that I wouldn't be able to do it. But shall
well,
I
you tell did
you
it.
A secret?
Yeah.
You crack them against each other with one hand. If you crack them against each other, you can break the shell.
And you know, and then you later in the book, a couple of times you say that because you had this friendship, because you had this rapport, I don't know if you would call it a friendship, but it was an on-air friendship. Mm-hmm. And then there were times in your career where things weren't going great or something would happen and they would keep making jokes. And you were at a point of saying, oh, all right, do you have to do that? And they kept doing it. I don't know. How did you come out of that feeling?
Well, it was hard because I asked Dave to let up, you know,
yeah.
And he wouldn't let up. I don't know why. Comedians are hard to analyze, I think, because I knew him off air a little bit, and he was not the same guy on air. I mean, he was much quieter, more serious. I didn't know him that well, but I spent a little time in his office, and he was mercurial.
The first time I ever saw your husband, I was living in Philadelphia and I went to go see a show called People Are Talking at KYW
yes.
Studios. And he was hosting that program.
Live from the studios of Channel 3 on Independence Mall East, it's People Are Talking. With Maury Povich. On today's show, soap opera's star-crossed lovers. And now here's Maury.
Here, this guy comes out and he does it better than anybody I've ever seen. He's got this amazing voice. My father immediately, because I was born in Washington, said, oh, my God, that's Shirley Povich's son. Uh-huh. And this is, you know, the guy. And I so many incredible interviews that he had in the city of Philadelphia. And that was, I mean, that was just one stop on the train for him because he had so many different gigs going along. But the fact that the two of you who even years before that had worked together briefly, then you fall in love and you have this incredible relationship and experience. It is a lovely story.
Joe, I had no idea you were from Washington. Will you forgive me? I didn't know that.
Oh, that's okay.
Where were you? You were born and raised in Washington?
Well, I was born in D.C. and then I was raised in Philadelphia. And it was just when I was, you know, very wide-eyed and wanted to be in broadcasting, I used to go down during the summer and they would give out free tickets to see People Are Talking. And I would go in and take the train down and watch Maury do this show, which was very unlike the Maury show that he would
yes.
end up doing. It was a very serious morning magazine program that yes. was just terrific.
Aren't you nice? And your father remembered that he was Shirley Povich.
Shirley Povich's son, yeah.
Uh-huh. Shirley Povich, who for your listeners was a legendary sports writer and columnist for the Washington Post for 75 years. Presidents read him. Even President Nixon, who hated the Washington Post, read for his father's sports columns every morning. In fact, he said, it's the only thing I read in the Washington Post. Nixon did.
The press room at the Washington National Stadium, named after
yes,
Shirley Povich.
Named yeah. after him. And they asked for some of his memorabilia and his manual typewriters there. It's really quite, you know, those old manual typewriters were so cool. He would really tap on his manual typewriter. And when he come to New York for a Yankees World Series one time, he was tapping on a manual typewriter. And it was just a glory to watch. And then he'd call rewrite, Joe, you know, and at the Washington Post to dictate his story to someone who is writing, you know, typing it out in Washington.
Connie Chung is our guest. Her new book is Connie, a memoir. We'll finish up our interview this morning by talking about her time at CBS and the disaster that was working with anchorman Dan Rather. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC. Welcome back as we finish up our conversation with broadcasting icon Connie Chung. For Connie, her dream job was at CBS to host the CBS Evening News, a role her mentor Walter Cronkite held for two decades. On June 1, 1993, she became the second woman, after Barbara Walters with ABC in 1976, to co-anchor a major network's national weekday news broadcast.
For President Clinton, a lurch to the center. An exclusive CBS News poll shows the president having to scramble to regain popularity lost.
The killing fields of Bosnia. Shelling kills children on a soccer field in Sarajevo while the world watches in horror.
And Eye on America. Tonight, rich kids, poor kids, and yellow school buses. Why mixing could be fixing.
This is the CBS Evening News with Dan Rather and Connie Chung.
Good evening and welcome, Connie.
Thank you, Dan.
Let us go back to earlier in our conversation when we talked to people with big shotitis. But now, those of us who study all of this know that Barbara Walters tried to do this with Harry Reasoner many years before you did it with Dan Rather. That didn't go well at all. He looked miserable from the time he got on the air to the time he got off the air. But then on that first broadcast, I remember watching it, and you sort of look for signs, you know, you see what this yes. team is going to be like. And then at the end.
Thank you for joining us and for all of us at CBS News. Good night. Good night, Chet.
Good night, David. Good night, everybody. See you tomorrow.
You say good night, Chet, and he says good night, David, and you're clasping hands and you think, well, how is this going to go wrong?
Right. And then it went sideways.
And looking back on it, there was no way it was ever going to work, was it?
That's right. You're spot on. It was an experiment that never should have happened. It's hard to share a half hour, even though Huntley and Brinkley were able to do it. They were in different cities. One was in New York and one was in Washington. There was a reason for them to be reporting certain stories. There was a division of duties. But with two people sitting next to each other for a half-hour program, it's pretty hard to divide it up. And Dan Rather didn't want to have a co-anchor. It was really, it's not that they put a gun to his head, but this was nothing that he wanted to have. He didn't want me there from the very beginning. And it was pretty clear, actually, behind the scenes until the day it collapsed 2 years later, same as Barbara Walters and Harry Reasoner.
Yeah. It was over. You were getting things that he wanted. You happened to be at places where you were closer to the action. He was on vacation or whatever. And just because you were doing it and he wasn't, that was not going to go over very well.
That was the end, really. Pretty much the final nail in the coffin. I could tell. But I didn't know it at the time when I went out and covered the story that he wanted to be on. But when I came back, I could tell that a tornado had gone through the newsroom and I was facing this gigantic aftermath. And I thought, oh, this is not boding well for me. So it happened. I got the axe. That was my true dream job. First dream job was just getting hired by CBS. And then when I came back to CBS and got the co-anchor job, I was mighty, mighty thrilled.
I certainly don't have the experience that you do with Dan Rather. I've done some events with him. I've interviewed him a couple of times. We were on stage together once. But one thing that did come to my mind, and I think of this because it's the third time we've mentioned it now, but here is a guy, unlike you, not much of a sense of humor. I'm just like, not Mr. Funny Pants.
No, Joe. No, you're right. I always think of people who don't have a sense of humor, they're a little too uptight. They can't, come on, loosen up, you know, give me just a little inch there.
And as good as he was, he'd be on the air for a long time. He had a lot of experience. And yet, there was a moment when you two were doing the news and one of the lights blows up.
And that's our news. Coming up later tonight on Eye to Eye, my interview with former hostage Michael Durant. And another exclusive, a conversation with Heidi Fleiss, the so-called Hollywood Madam. Eye to Eye tonight. Oh, that was a light that just went out above us. That's all it was. Don't worry. Eye to Eye tonight at a special time. We just wanted to get your attention. A special time tonight at 10 o'clock Eastern and Pacific, 9 Central. See you then.
Hey, folks, it's live television.
That's right.
Connie and I, lights willing, we'll see you again tomorrow here on the CBS Evening News. Thanks for being with us. Good night, everybody.
Good night.
And you immediately make a joke out of it, and he just looking around like there's snipers in the air, and it's very funny to watch.
You remember that?
Oh, that was something. I do remember that.
I can't believe all these moments that you remember. No, it's so great. It's such a pleasure, Joe. Everything that you brought up from that Maury, from A Current Affair, the bus traveling,
yeah,
David Letterman, and all these little moments that I chuckle over because I can see the scene. And you've just brought them all back to me. Thank you.
Well, you're very welcome. I was fascinated because you talk a lot about, as your career started to wrap up, how concerned you were about your reputation.
Yes.
And you bring it up regularly in the book about concern about your reputation. Mm-hmm. And I ask the question in two ways. One is, the thing that is cockeyed about it is that when you were concerned about your reputation, you were doing, let's say, tabloidy things that were getting incredible ratings that anybody would give their eye teeth for, but it wasn't what you wanted to do, and it was keeping you then from being serious and to do the type of work that you thought you were capable of and that was being done by your colleagues.
You're spot on. It wasn't what I wanted to do. And unfortunately, because of rating success, which was paramount to the networks, was killing me in the wrong direction that I wanted to be going in. It was easy to do the tabloid stories. So the serious stories are more challenging and more gratifying. And it wasn't until much later that in the beginning of my career and the end of my career, when I was doing more serious, worthy stories, that I got the most gratification from. In other words, the story, it sounds so corny. I know it sounds so corny, but can't help it. It's the stories that made a difference in government policy or the way government is operating or a social misconception.
Right.
That it's corrected. That's what journalism is all about. And it's so much more satisfying to accomplish some kind of important issue than just to really entertain, which is what a lot of the stories that I was doing for a period of time that had blockbuster ratings, they were very entertaining. And sure, we want relief as viewers from the deadly serious, but you know, it's just the way it was at the time.
I read this in the book. It struck me, but it didn't strike me as much as when I saw your husband, Maury, talk about this with Jane Pauley on the CBS Sunday News. And you were talking about the conversation came up about your legacy and about that reputation. And Maury says it isn't until Generation Connie comes in, that he believes you finally realized the impact you had on broadcast journalism.
And I think it took the Connie generation for her to realize exactly what she had become.
Last year, the New York Times published a story entitled Generation Connie. Chinese, Korean, and Japanese parents across the country had named their baby daughters after her.
I couldn't believe it. It was the most exhilarating day that I could have ever imagined.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's a beautiful story where you were reached out to from someone who was named Connie after you. And then you realize there are all of these Connies that are named after you. The New York Times puts them together and you get to meet them. I had a hard time keeping it together when he was talking about it. And it's just because it must have been so gratifying. You know, you never think you do that great of a job, and you're always trying to do better. And you know, you're just trying to keep your job. And then suddenly somebody tells you that what you did made a difference. What a lovely thing to have, especially at this point in your career.
Joe, you said it so beautifully. I feel like you and I really understand that feeling of, well, we're just doing our best. I'm trying to learn more every day. And I think if we tried to match our humility, we'd be on the same plane.
Looking for a mountaintop to crash into, perhaps,
exactly.
But still.
Yeah. Exactly. Why is it that every time I look up, I see another mountain that I need to climb? I tended to enjoy self-flagellation much more than declaring success or glory. So yes, you're right. Once these Connies came along, I was so blown away. And my husband said, you see, he said, I'm not surprised, but I know you're surprised. It's true. I was shocked. And I keep meeting more new Connies. Believe it or not, I received some award at a dinner, and these wonderful people at this dinner decided to gather as many Connies. They asked actually Connie Wong, the one who discovered this phenomenon, to contact as many Connies as she could. And they literally flew in from hither and yon and joined me on stage. I mean, do you think I cried or what? Seriously, I couldn't believe it. And they, on their own money, a few of them flew in from the West Coast and took red eyes to be there. I just am blown away. But I will tell you one thing. I even met a Connie in drag.
There you go. That's perfect. A perfect way, right? You know, I obviously love this profession, and I've read a lot of memoirs by broadcast journalists. Yours is so beautifully written and so meticulous and so telling and revealing. And I know it must have been very hard for you, for all the reasons that we just mentioned, to talk about yourself this way and to give us an honest appraisal. But what a beautiful piece of work. And I congratulate you on it. And I thank you so much for being with us. This means more to me than you'll ever know.
Joe, I want to crawl on your shoulder and just put my head down and say thank you. Thank you so much. You're just so warm and cuddly. And I seriously, you know, it's crazy that your voice is so comforting, and I can't tell you how much I appreciate it. And thank you for, you know, I never thought I was a good writer, and this was so hard. Not only because my publisher told me, you're just giving me the facts when I first submitted my first draft. And I said, but that's what I do. And she said, no, you got to tell me how you feel. And I thought, oh my God, I never would have done this if I had to tell how I felt. So it was a torturous process. And I'm so delighted that you felt as if I put a button on it. Well, I can't believe it, but I thank you.
And it's so you too, because even at the end of chapters, you're like, and more on that coming up.
You can't take the broadcaster out of you either. Got to do the tease properly.
You got it.
Connie Chung, an absolute delight to speak to you. I wish you all the luck in the world. Give my best to Maury, and thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you. I'll tell Maury what you said. He'll be very happy.
Connie Chung's new book is Connie, a memoir. It is published by Grand Central. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.